Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz, episode 29 for May 23rd, 2008. Dan Ingles. This show and the entire TWiT broadcast network is brought to you by donations from listeners like you. Thanks. It's time for Floss Weekly, the regular look at open source, free and libre software with Mr. Randall Schwartz, who is very well known, of course, as a Perl programmer, the author of Learning Perl. And I've ensconced it now in our bookshelf, your Pearls of Wisdom.
Ooh, it's right near where here. People can see if they're looking at the live TV feed right now.
You know, if I turn my camera over, we've got the whole Pearl shelf. I've got Learning Perl, Perl Cookbook, Programming Perl, Practical Mod Perl, and Randall Schwartz's Pearls of Wisdom.
So my words are in just about every one of those books you've just
Isn't
mentioned.
Isn't that amazing?
Cool. Very
but
cool.
I guess it's not Perl anymore for Randall. He's gone small talk.
I like small talk. It's true.
Tell us a little bit about our next guest, Dan Ingles. You've been so excited about this interview.
I have been looking forward to this for months, and I've just been able to get it sort of negotiated out the last couple of days. So it's really came together rather quickly in terms of the final scheduling. Dan Ingles, the first interaction I had with Dan Ingles was about, I'm going to guess, 7 or 8 years ago. On the Smalltalk mailing list, on the Squeak mailing list, sorry.
Squeak, we've talked about this before. Squeak is the modern version of Smalltalk.
Yeah.
Free, open source.
Yeah, Squeak. Squeak is a kind of Smalltalk, right? And I first, you know, when Alan Kay and Dan Ingles, as far as they created Squeak and they brought it out as open source, and I signed up for the mailing list and I downloaded Squeak, started playing with it on my machine, and was really excited about that. But when they were actually starting to post answers to questions on there to help the community along, to help Squeak be developed on other platforms and to get it further developed, it was like to be able to ask a question of and have Dan Ingles respond, and you know, because I knew that Dan and Alan had come up with Smalltalk, that they'd actually created it back in the early days, and that's the thing that, you know, that Apple had seen in order to create what we now see as Windows and mice and the whole nine yards. And I thought, well, this is definitely a pioneer. And
is he as well known as Alan Kay is for this?
I don't think so. I think it's because, you know, he was more the grunt guy. You know, it's kind of like
the guy who did all the work, probably.
It's kind of like the two Steves. You know, we know Steve Jobs everywhere, and we know Woz because, you know, you're really, you know, a good
Woz
friend of Woz.
Woz is the guy, though. Woz did all the work.
But Jobs is the front man. And I think that's sort of, I don't say there's exactly the same relationship there, but Dan's kind of Dan Ingles is sort of like the low-level guy, the actual guy kind of building the detailed stuff, and Alan was more the visionary, kind of pulling the things together.
Clearly, Dan's a brilliant guy. We've got a bachelor's in physics from Harvard, a master's in electrical engineering from Stanford. He's worked at Xerox PARC. He's worked at Apple. He's worked at Interval Research. He's worked at Hewlett-Packard. He's currently at Xerox. His project at Xerox, I can't wait to find out about this, is called Lively Kernel. The Lively Kernel.
You mean Sun? You said Xerox.
Did I say Sun? I mean Sun.
Yes.
Yeah. No. Xerox was early in his career. Now he's at Sun. Yeah.
Yeah. The Lively Kernel, and
he's
also
a distinguished engineer at Sun. Won many awards. He's got the ACM Grace Murray Hopper Award for Outstanding Young Scientist in 1984. That was for his work at PARC, including something called BitBlit, which is now BitBlit is something that's used in pretty much every computer game for the first 20 years of computer gaming.
Yep, still being used today on pretty much every machine to some form of it in order to be able to move things around on the screen.
Blasting those bits on the screen.
Another thing, I don't think your bio list, but he's also now back on the Squeak board with me.
Oh, great.
So we both share that as a shared thing. And that's actually kind of how I started getting to talk to him, to get him for this podcast. This
Fantastic.
Is really nice that he's on the board again. Yeah.
Let's say hello to he's in his home in Aptos, California, in the beautiful Santa Cruz area by the beach, Mr. I'm going to say his full name, Daniel Henry Holmes Ingles Jr.
The very same.
Wow.
That must be the longest title for a bio in Wikipedia.
Yeah, I don't know. I just gave a talk in Germany, and in Germany, the letter H is pronounced Ha.
Uh huh.
So with those two middle names, it's
Daniel Ha
Ha. Kind of right.
Daniel Ha Ha Ingalls. I like it.
So my father must have liked it because he made me a junior after his right. stay in Germany.
Oh, ooh. You're kidding.
No.
Do you think he did that on purpose?
I have no idea.
Oh, so he lived in Germany. Oh, how interesting.
He didn't live there. He went there to study musical composition for a couple of years.
Oh, good. So Daniel is a distinguished engineer at Sun. He is principal investigator from Sun of the Lively Kernel Project. I love the name. It's a project to rethink web programming and the web itself. He's also done several generations of Smalltalk environments. He did the Squeak. You did Squeak, or you worked on Squeak?
Well, just about every project I've worked on has had a bunch of people on it. Right. I think I had the original idea for Squeak and then worked on it with a couple of other people.
Neat. Really neat. And were you at HP when you did Squeak?
No, I was, I was really just sort of leaving Interval.
Oh, okay. Interval. I remember Interval.
Yeah.
That was the Paul Allen. You were at Interval probably when I was at Tech TV because we kept seeing all the money Paul was pouring in at Interval.
Could be.
And saying, why not us, Paul? We want those fancy chairs.
Yeah.
Was Interval a good experience for you or not?
Oh, I enjoyed it. Yeah. I enjoyed it.
It was Blue Sky, wasn't it? Blue Sky R&D research.
Yeah, almost a little bit too blue. So I think there was sort of an idea there that the way to manage researchers is to give them the resources they need and get out of the way. And this, I think, is good once people have got their focus. But until they get their focus, there's a kind of a different style that I think is needed, which is to feed them with what's needed and wanted and exciting.
You worked at Xerox PARC with Alan Kay. Was PARC's attitude a little different? Was it more like that?
Yeah. PARC did a good job of both of those phases. And it was a wonderful, wonderful place. And they managed to work it so that there was enough feeling of common vision that you would, you know, pour your energy into your project, kind of knowing that it would enrich the other stuff going on and vice versa.
Mm.
PARC was kind of notorious, though, for inventing all the stuff that we now take for granted in the computer world, but not ever turning any of it into a business. I mean, I guess that if you're Xerox, that's a bad thing. I don't know if it's a bad thing for the rest of the world.
Yeah, it worked out pretty well for the rest of the world.
It's only Xerox that. In fact, I remember I interviewed the author of a book how Xerox PARC invented the world and lost its business or whatever it was. But yeah, it's only Xerox's problem. I mean, with the mouse, graphical user interfaces, Smalltalk, all of this came out of PARC.
Oh, that good stuff, right?
Yeah. So. Is that where you started working on Smalltalk was with Alan at PARC?
Yeah. Yep. And I guess when I came there, it didn't exist. This has been recorded elsewhere, but it began with, I wasn't even in Alan's group. I was working across the hall on a speech recognition project. I kept noticing that I was more interested in the conversations across the hall in Alan's office than I was in what I was doing. So eventually I went across the hall and said, hey, what's the chance of working together? And
you know,
so
that's a really big problem now that we're all working in diverse groups and working from home and things like that. We don't have that across the hallway crossbreeding on projects.
Yeah.
Although the internet gives you a lot of that. You don't have some of that kind of audible contact, but you've got a huge amount of other networking contact.
I'm across 27,000 halls.
Yes, there you go.
Do you work at home now more, or do you go into work? What is your work situation right now at Sun?
It's a mixture. I work at home for 2 days a week, and then I come in for 3 days a week.
So you get the
and
best it of seems, both worlds.
Yeah. It seems that it sort of depends what the nature of your relationship is with the other people you're working with, kind of how much face time you need.
Right. Yep. Your dad was a professor of Sanskrit. That's Daniel Haha Ingalls Senior, right?
Right. Yep. It's true.
That's cool. Did you get an interest
in unusual languages in our?
No kidding. Yeah. Did you get an interest in language from that? Do you think?
If so, it was at the unconscious level. He did read it out loud because he liked. I don't know. That was just his way of doing it. So I got a lot of it, subconsciously, I guess.
If you hear Sanskrit now, can you kind of understand it? Or?
No, I never really got to where I could understand it much. I got a little bit of. I did a project with him to do optical character recognition of Sanskrit, which I did in Smalltalk. Wow. And from that, I learned the basic letters, you know, and how to pronounce some of the sounds, and about 20 lines of the Bhagavad Gita, I guess. But no, I never really learned it.
Easier to do OCR for Sanskrit than for English characters?
Not at all. I don't know if you've ever looked at Devanagari script, but it's, you know, it's all one big glob, and there's pieces of vowels sticking off the top and consonants hanging down and pieces of vowels hanging off the consonants. And plus, none of it was typeset on a machine. So there's, you know, weirdness in the type. You know, every printed character is slightly different from the next.
It's almost like reading handwriting then.
Yeah, almost.
Yeah.
So back to Park for a second. Now, when you were overhearing these conversations across the hallway, what piqued your interest the most, and how did you get started involved with Alan's group?
Well, I had been interested in just simple interactive languages. So I guess, you know, the first that I encountered was BASIC. But then after that, APL, I thought was really neat.
You didn't get destroyed by BASIC. That's good to know.
Now, you know, I think I'm kind of an agnostic that way. I get excited by anything that you can pick up and play with. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I got excited with BASIC because it came with this thing called the Epson, what was it, EX20 or something like that. It was this tiny little sort of the first laptop with a 20 character by four line screen.
The HX20, and it had a little grocery, grocery tape printer.
Yeah. So it actually, you could generate hard copy from it. You could store stuff on tape and all that stuff. And so I had lots of fun doing, and you could play music on it with the BASIC if you did the right things. But I remember having an aha there, which I think sort of maybe predicted some of my future life at that time, which was I got into the BASIC trying to, you know, build things that it didn't have. I think it didn't have a renumber command. So I wrote that or something like that. But it seemed to me, you know, here's this wonderful interactive system, but why can't I get at the system itself? And I thought, gee, if only they had done it in itself, then they could have put the interpreter on negative line numbers, and, you know, everybody could really have fun with it.
Wow. So you were metaprogramming all the way back then. You were already thinking about programs that alter programs.
I guess so. You know, not consciously, but that's what I wanted to do.
Were you a kid? Was this your first computer or?
Yeah, I mean, I came to computers somewhat late just because of my chronological, age.
Right.
So didn't have the chance to play with stuff when I was a kid.
Yeah, well.
I mean, I was much more into physical stuff.
Right.
And actually, my training was in physics anyway.
Did that help you think when you're talking about an object-oriented language that you were used to manipulating real-world objects?
Boy, I can't tell you. I have often reflected, though, that I think physics is one of the best sort of educational backgrounds for anybody who's going to, you know, think sort of constructive thoughts. Because, you know, the process of solving problems in physics is kind of one of identifying all the forces and relationships and then isolating them. So you do have to think of how objects or parts of a system are by themselves and how they interact with the rest to do a good job that way. So that part of the thinking is real similar.
Yeah. Yeah.
So now back in the Park days again, like, so you're working with Alan. Is there,
you can't let go of this, can you?
I'm excited about this early part of the history.
I know. I understand completely. I've only seen Alan Kay speak once, but it kind of so opened my eyes that I completely understand, you know, and everything that came out of Park was so revolutionary. I mean, to get to talk to Dan, you know, somebody who was there, it's very exciting. Yeah. I understand.
So again, the Windows and mice thing, was that sort of inherent in the design to start with, or is it, no, there was some command line stuff earlier first, right?
Yeah, we certainly thought just in terms of mice and bitmap displays.
Of mice and bitmaps.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So there was a lot going on at Xerox at that time that was sort of that drew on the work at SRI, the Stanford Research Institute, where Doug Engelbart was and had his project, where, you know, they had invented the mouse and were working on with sort of hypertext documents. And then there was work going on at Xerox because of Xerox's sort of investment in the office and paper with better displays. So those two things really played together well.
And that sort of carried it forward. Now, how long, what span of time are we talking about from between the first concept and the first sort of time that something sort of was real in front of you? Is that like months or weeks or days?
Oh, let's see. So, in terms of, I assume you're talking here about sort of the birth of Smalltalk rather than bitmap displays and all that stuff at Xerox.
No, given that as a background, yes.
Yeah, so it kind of began with, we had been having conversations in our group with Alan about ways to do small, simple, interactive systems. And from my interest in APL, and Alan had the same interest, there was another system written called PPL, which was polymorphic. So mm-hmm. It had some better behaviors than that. And then Alan sort of was reflecting, kind of based on the, I don't know if you're familiar with the Lisp interpreter written in itself.
Yes.
McCarthy. Anyway, it's just about a half a page of code. And Alan was convinced that you could do an object system with that kind of terseness. And, you know, Ted Kaler and I said to him, well, okay, you do it and we'll make it go. Alan sort of went away for a week and then came back with something that was about, you know, a page of code, kind of, you know, handwritten code, not anything that would run. So we stewed over that, and I guess got to the point where we saw that things actually maybe would run. So then I went away for, a couple of weeks. And believe it or not, this was in BASIC, because it happened that I had a couple of really young kids at home. So I wanted to be at home, and the only interactive system I had at home was a BASIC system. But in BASIC, I wrote an interpreter for essentially Smalltalk 72.
Wow.
Which ran at a pace that was, glacial. But anyway, it allowed us to kind of debug the thing and get a version of it that actually did what we thought it would do. Mm-hmm. And then I spent the next little while basically transliterating all of that to Nova assembly code, which is what ran on our machines. And that became Smalltalk 72.
Wow. Is that the processor of, I think, like the Dolphin, or the, is that?
No, it was way before that. So at first we actually ran it on actual Nova, Data General Nova mini computers.
Ah, okay.
And then because the Alto was the first of the Xerox machines, and none of them were actually running yet. Mm-hmm. It was really nice timing, just about the time that we had things sort of running solidly on the Novas, the Altos started running, and they were pretty much code compatible with the Nova. So there was a microcode emulator for the Nova instruction set. Mm-hmm. So then we moved over there and were able to then implement the bitmap graphics that we needed on the Alto. And then things got exciting from then on.
And not to go through every hour of every day of that period of time, because we'd be here for like a million years. But so you had a couple of generations of Smalltalk after that. What drove the major break, say, between 72 and 76 and 76 and 80? What sort of drove that?
Okay. Smalltalk 72 was a delightfully simple scripting system, but it was really slow, and it had some modularity problems. So, you know, if you put together two applications, you couldn't be sure that they would work together. part of the problem was there was also what I consider a general linguistic problem, which was that the way it worked was it sort of did on the fly pattern matching to discover where messages were being sent to objects. And, and as a result, you could not tell how a message would be parsed without looking at the code of the object that was the receiver. And so this, it turns out to be actually a problem in human understanding, as well as, computation.
We have the same problem in Perl, so I know exactly what you're talking about.
Well, I think that's a general problem.
Okay.
And one worth paying attention to. And then just as you can be sure that if a person can't read it, then a computer probably can't read it. And so, which is true, it was uncompilable for that reason. and it ran really slow as an interpreter. I mean, you know, well, it ran usably. Shoot, on today's machines, it would probably run fine. Basically, in Smalltalk 72, we got to learn about all the things we would like in an object-oriented system, and we did a rev on it to try to make it a little bit better. But I don't know consciously how this happened, but I had gone away to the beach with my family for a week, and just found myself designing kind of a whole new take on this. And part of it was I just kept thinking that I could come up with a syntax that would somehow have the sort of English-like character of Smalltalk 72, but that would be compilable.
And be a minimal number of things, like maybe, you know, the whole idea of blocks and stuff, being able to build control structures out of that.
Yeah, right.
Came in that.
Yeah, and then although there was no direct carryover, Peter Deutsch recently had done a Lisp system that used byte encoding for the instruction set. And I didn't use any of that, but it was in my mind that, you know, there's a wonderful thing that a wonderful effect that came about from the fact that those early machines at Xerox were microcoded, because a very small amount of computer memory could run instructions blazingly fast. So the Alto ran the Nova instruction set, you know, at about, 2 microseconds per instruction, but the individual microcycles ran 5 per microsecond, so 10 times faster. So you knew that if you could somehow come up with a small kernel of stuff, like a small instruction set, that you'd be able to run that really fast. And that was what was so cool about the bytecoded instruction set, which was a language specific instruction set. So I had that in my mind, and that's what sort of came up, you know, caused me to come up with the various instructions that make up what became the Smalltalk 76 virtual machine. And that is really essentially the same as the Smalltalk 80 virtual machine.
Yeah, I was just going to ask about that. So that didn't change much. I know one of the big changes between 76 and 80 was the fact that you made everything an object, including the stacks. You had a reflexive execution model, right?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
Yeah.
And a few other things. We made Booleans be a class and stuff like that.
And at what point did Apple come by? At what point did the Steves come by and take a look at this?
That happened just before, around the time of Smalltalk 80. It was a little bit before the public release.
Mm-hmm. Now, out of that, you had some conversations with them. Did you leave to go to Apple after that? I can't remember the history there.
That was a while after. Yeah, so Steve came by. I think that at the time, Xerox was thinking of investing some money in Apple, and then Apple was interested in... I wasn't privy to the higher level conversations, but some licensing or something like that. Mm-hmm. And so this precipitated a demo in which it was mainly Larry Tesler and I gave demos to Steve.
So this mm-hmm. is that very famous demo that inspired him to make the Mac.
Yeah, right. Yep.
Wow.
Well, yeah. And, you know, I can't tell you what ingredients fit into what, but yeah, I sort of had the sense that he went back and said, I want something like that.
Did his eyes get wide when you were showing him this stuff, or what was it that interested him?
Oh, well, everybody liked it.
So, yeah. I mean, this wasn't the Alto. This was pre-Alto, right?
No, things were running on the Alto.
It was the Alto. Okay.
Yeah.
So he'd probably seen an Alto in somewhere, I would imagine. Yeah. I mean, they were being sold. Not very many got sold, but they were being
sold. No, I don't think they were being sold at this point.
Oh, okay. Okay.
I don't know. Well, you know.
So this might have been the first time he'd seen a GUI.
I have to be careful in that, you know, I remember everything sort of happening at the same time, so I'm the wrong person to ask.
Well, that's not that important. But he clearly saw something there. Was it obvious as you were showing him that he was getting jazzed about this?
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yep. You couldn't help but get jazzed about it because, you know, everything was so so very graphical compared to what had been going on before. Yeah. And in our case, so very dynamic. I mean, you know, the thing that I did while he was there... you know, we were displaying text and various stuff in Smalltalk. Mm-hmm. And he said, he asked something for Larry. And then he said, well, can you make the text scroll up, not line by line, but smoothly? And I was able to, in the process, in the course of that demo, write the code so that it would actually do that. And that's, I think that sort of amazed everybody.
Yeah.
That certainly set the standard for the malleability of a language, especially that you had source at your fingertips all the way down to your VM, making it easy to make any change anywhere in the system.
Yep.
I guess I should have known that it was Smalltalk you were really demoing. I don't know if that really has gotten out there in the world, if people really realize that. I think everybody thinks, oh, Windows and menus and mice, but it was really a Smalltalk environment.
Yeah, that was Smalltalk stuff. Now, I can't remember whether he saw any other of the software at Xerox, but I think in a way, at that demo, it was kind of intentionally just Smalltalk, so that because Xerox was more protective of their other software at the time.
They thought, this is just some little side project.
Yeah, who knows?
Now, did you have a sense when you were doing this demo, or maybe as you're building the last few revs of Smalltalk before up to Smalltalk 80, that this was revolutionary and might change the way everybody interacts with computers in the future, as it actually has?
Oh, yeah. I mean,
we knew that, it seemed
really exciting, but, you know, not everything that's exciting necessarily succeeds. Right. You know?
True.
But yeah, I mean, we definitely had the experience that this was the most productive environment we could imagine.
You know, what's interesting, though, is that Apple didn't make a Smalltalk environment. I mean, the first Mac wasn't Smalltalk.
Oh, they did. The Lisa ran Smalltalk.
Oh, but the Lisa ran Smalltalk. Okay.
Yeah, it was too expensive.
But be careful, because it's true that the Lisa was made to run Smalltalk, but it was not implemented in Smalltalk.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So that was just another Smalltalk project that was, you know, not that significant. Well, actually, the truth is, so the Lisa Smalltalk actually became the Apple Smalltalk that I worked on after I went to Apple, which then became Squeak ultimately.
Right. So, talk about that path again. How did that originate, and how do we now have Squeak?
Okay, so it began with Xerox released Smalltalk 80 to a couple of companies, it was released to a number of companies that included, let's see, Tektronix. And Apple and DEC, I believe, and there might have been one other. Basically, to get it out in the world and to encourage implementations. And those companies got a liberal version of the license that said that they could redistribute it. So that happened, and it only really took off at Tektronix, but the folks at Apple did an implementation that ran on the Lisa, and that kind of got worked on and then got dropped. And then I went to Apple in, I guess, around 84, and there was the Apple implementation sort of sitting on a shelf, and I picked it up and got it going to the point that it, you know, ran competitively. Mm-hmm. And we did some other engineering on it and then released it as not as an Apple product, but as part of the what was called the Apple Developers, Apple Programmers and Developers Association. And so it went out and various people got interested in it and played with it.
Now that the VM was written in what, 68K assembly?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
So then that, let's see, not a great deal was done with that. We did some things internally with it. I did the Fabric visual programming system in it. And
that's Fabric
I left
with a
Apple.
K, by the way. People are going to look it up. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's in the good German style.
Well, yeah, it was sort of a pun on the German meaning of that, which is a factory. Then I left in 87 to go to a completely different part of my life, which is I took over a family business that in Virginia.
You ran an inn. You became Basil Fawlty.
That's right. You get it.
Did you do that too? Were you kind of like the Basil Fawlty character?
No, this was it's a big resort business. Oh. It was
Now, why did you do that? Were you fed up with the technology, or did you just need a break?
I was sort of called upon.
It was a family thing.
Yeah, right. It was a family thing. So
was that hard? I mean, how long did you do that?
For 8 years. Yeah, it was a complete change, and it was a wonderfully enriching part of my life, but I was glad to be free of the responsibility by the end.
Did you do any programming during those 8 years? I mean, did you stay in touch with all of this?
Almost none. I did kind of stay peripherally in touch, and I did do one programming thing, which was, I guess maybe this was just to keep from, keep from going nuts, but I wrote a computer weather station. This was a resort hotel, and they had, a barometer and a recording thermometer by the front door. And right. I noticed that whenever the weather was really bad and the guests couldn't go out and do what they wanted to do, that they liked to watch the weather instruments, you know? So I thought, oh, well, that's cool. We can do better than that. And right at that time, there were weather stations coming available that had RS-232 outputs. So I did this weather station that sort of showed all the weather parameters and showed them as a strip chart. So the guests had even more to watch when they were not able to go out and do what they wanted. And that actually was useful because when I left the hotel business and hadn't yet gotten back into the computer business, I sold this weather station as a company to get along. Mm. But anyway, that's a digression. So,
but that's it's an 8 year digression. It's kind of an amazing thing to just stop cold and then come back to it. Did you feel like you lost brain cells doing that, or did it come right?
No,
back
not
to
at
it?
All. I feel like I kind of came back with a recharged.
Yeah.
And the other thing that was fascinating to me. Now I don't know if this, somebody else who studies the course of computers could answer this better than I, but it felt to me when I came back as though nothing had progressed in the world of computer software. I mean, it seemed like exactly what I had left before.
What years were these?
So we're talking here between 87 and 96.
Oh, you're right. Nothing happened.
But the whole web happened.
Yeah.
The web hadn't quite happened yet. 96 was when... That was Netscape went public in 96.
So. That was the release of Pearl. Pearl stopped everything else.
No, but you're in a way, I'm trying to think. I think you're kind of right. It was kind of a great time.
Well, that was my sense of it anyway, at least certainly in the areas that I was interested. And yet, the hardware had gotten immeasurably faster. I could not believe it. You know, everything, factors of 10 and 100, speed, space. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, when I had left, if there was one sort of weakness that Smalltalk had, it was that it was too slow.
Right.
So this got things going in the back of my mind. And so when I was, I guess where I wound up coming back to was Interval. Mm-hmm. And there was a project going on there that was in need of something like Smalltalk. And I wound up working with them on getting a Smalltalk running. And the way we did it was to revive that APTA release of Apple Smalltalk and write a new VM. We couldn't deal with the 68,000 code, but we wrote one in C that would run the same image. So that gave us, you know, a tool to use for that work at Interval. And then just as I was sort of leaving Interval, I realized that things were so fast that you actually could have done what we did in C by, let's see, I'm going to digress for a minute. When we released Smalltalk 80 from Xerox, we also wrote a reference interpreter entirely in Smalltalk. And that's in the original version of the so-called Blue Book about Smalltalk.
Yep.
And I worked on that together with Dave Robson. And so that code was around, and it occurred to me that things were running so fast that it might actually make a usable Smalltalk. And then what's more, I knew that was written in a version of Smalltalk that did not use all of the object-oriented aspects of Smalltalk. So it should be possible to translate it to C automatically. So that was the germ that bore Squeak. Mm-hmm. And it was right at that time that I was leaving to go join Alan's group at Apple again. So they were looking for a Smalltalk that they could sort of, or at least some system that they could completely control and use, you know, for the work in education. So we set about building such a Smalltalk, and it went really fast. I think it was in December that I started, and we had an actual Smalltalk running by February in sort of simulation mode, and by March with stuff translated to C.
That was done using the slang, right? The subset of Smalltalk that you could translate mechanically into C.
Yeah, but see, I mean, we now call it slang, but that was actually the idea that Dave Robson and I was a part of that at Xerox had done for the reference interpreter in the book.
Mm.
So that the notion of doing that had been around for a long time. And we had done another similar project at Xerox where we translated a subset of Smalltalk like slang into BCPL for a virtual memory that we built. But you're right. That's how it got started.
So just to bring everybody up to speed at home, one of the cool things about Squeak is that the virtual machine is written in Smalltalk and translated mechanically to C along with some support code that goes with it. Wow. And so when you're building a new version of the VM, you can first simulate it using Smalltalk's tools because it's just Smalltalk.
Right.
And then you push the button and out comes the C code. You recompile that and now you're running on the new VM.
It's like that Lisp. It's the snake that's eating its own tail.
Right. Yeah.
Love it.
I've always sort of pushed for a system like that. I mean, we may come back to this kind of topic. There's an upside and a downside with doing things that way. Mm-hmm. But the upside is that if you can do everything, if you can manage to get everything described in a single language, it becomes the case that, you know, if somebody learns that one language, they can sort of be master of all of it without having to learn that much. And that's always been a point of leverage that I have liked. You know, the downside is that if you do things that way, you know, there may be parts of the rest of the world that you don't have access to. But within that world you've created, you have complete access to and control over, and have to learn very little in doing so. So in a way, part of my goal in this project was to get the speed of C, but not have to learn C. So I had.
You don't know C?
Well, I do, you know, but I don't. Not C hacker at all.
Yeah.
So we managed to pull off this project without Dan having to learn C, because John did the translator, and basically you can simulate Smalltalk in Smalltalk in that system and never have to understand C.
Wow.
So,
and so that became the germ. Now that's sort of the beginning of Squeak. Did you do that while you were still at Apple then?
Yeah. Yep. Okay. And it was from Apple that we released Squeak.
You and Alan were both fellows at the time, right?
No, I was never a fellow.
Oh, okay.
No, Alan was. Yeah.
You were just an employee, huh?
Yep. That's right.
Why did Apple, want to develop Squeak?
You know, at the time, so it, you have to realize that Squeak, Smalltalk existed at Apple in two sort of different periods. The first was when they were a recipient of the Xerox release. And I think then, you know, they thought they could do a lot of the kinds of things we were doing with Smalltalk, and that they could be a big part of their, you know, their business. And as it turns out, it wasn't a big part of their business. And so they kind of dropped it after a year or so.
Mm-hmm.
Then this second time was, it wasn't so much Apple that was interested as Alan's specific education group.
Ah.
And in there, it was wanted for, you know, the reasons of malleability, its high level description, you know, and all of that, all of those good things. But I don't think that Apple was that interested in it. And in fact, it's probably, let's see. So in my return to Apple, I think some people sort of squinted their eyes and said, oh no, not more small talk. And I think that's kind of, I more than think that's a fair part of the reason that Alan and all of us gave it a different name, which was to allow it to be still politically correct.
What do you mean politically correct? They didn't want to be small talk?
Yeah, there was not a lot of interest in supporting more small talk work at that point.
Oh, but it's Squeak.
Yeah, right. It's Squeak for education, right? It's good.
What's wrong with Squeak? Yeah. Well, and as it turns out, it's an amazing educational tool. It's on, as we've mentioned before, it's on the OLPC. And
that's right.
Yeah. I've played with it. It's wonderful. It's really fun. You know, it's a shame in a way that Smalltalk came out when it did. Of course, it fueled the whole revolution. But now that machines are so fast that there really isn't any penalty to using something like that, I wish more people were using it.
Yep. Yep.
Maybe Seaside and things like that are going to make that change. That's the framework you like, right, Randall?
Yes, yes, Seaside. Yeah, you got Seaside, the right there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what happened to Squeak after you brought it out as an open source release from Apple, yep. under the Apple license, which now is not quite open source. We're going through that process right now. Now you went then to Disney from there?
Yeah, yep.
Because you had project? Sorry.
Move to Disney.
So you moved to Disney because of you had Squeak and you wanted to build like interfaces for them for various rides and stuff, or what?
Let's see. I'll give you my point of view about it, which was that Disney seemed more interested in the kinds of educational things we could do. And I think Alan saw the opportunity. If we could pull off a really nice educational environment, that Disney would be second to none in the ability to get it out in the world.
Right.
So that was the opportunity we were looking for. But of course, you know, the reality you encounter in any company may be different from what the potential is. And, you know, we did a number of cool things there, but it never quite fully manifested.
Now, there was some display or something at Disney World that was driven by Squeak some brightness, one of the things you ended up doing.
Yep. There was a neat sort of submarine game, and yep.
Did you have space? What is it? Mars Journey to Mars 2029? What was that Disney ride where the seats inflate? You could probably do that very easily in small talk.
Seats deflate.
That's it. That's all there is. It's not much of a ride.
Now. And so the Squeak had sort of this, this is sort of where I became involved back again with Smalltalk, is having seen Squeak and seeing you announce it and on the various mailing lists and stuff. And I became sort of excited very early on that now I could run Smalltalk again, because I'd worked at Gemstone before it became Gemstone back in the early days.
Yep.
And I was also at Tektronix back before, you know, playing with the Magnolia there, the 68K implementation they made on it too. So here comes along Squeak, and now I'm getting to actually play with Smalltalk again. And it was really exciting. I got to tell you, I've got a little bit of fanboy worship here, because I tell you, it was really fun seeing you on the early mailing list, you know, talking back and forth and saying, well, back in Smalltalk 72, we did this. It was really, really great that you stuck with the project and helped shepherd it through some of its earlier years.
Yeah. Yep. And the release of Squeak was, we were so jazzed about it. And, and as you say, I think it excited a lot of people outside who had been partial or complete Smalltalk enthusiasts, because it was in a way like a return to the good old days. I mean, it was a small system and simple. And yet it was so much more open by the fact that it now included its virtual machine. So when you got the Squeak release, you got absolutely everything. You could take it off to a desert island and port it to some other machine that didn't exist, because you had everything in it. And that was exciting. And then out of that possibility, and this, you know, there's a lot of open source background in your show. I'll make this plug for it. It was incredible. When we put it out, running on the Mac, but with all of the source for the virtual machine in itself. It was only, I think, like 2 weeks later that Ian Piumarda had it running on Linux. And Only about 2 or 3 weeks after that, that Andreas Robb had it running on the PC, on Windows. So, you know, there's 1 month out in the world with us not having to do a lick of work, and all of a sudden it was like the most cross-platform high-level environment in existence. I mean, it exploded.
And not only that, it really is write once, run everywhere. You're running the exact same image file in all three of those environments.
Yep, bit identical. Mm-hmm. I mean, every bit on the screen. Yep.
Very cool. I mean, just recently I was doing work on an OpenBSD machine, and there wasn't a binary VM for that, but I was able to download the Unix sources, compile it up, work with it on my Mac laptop, upload it, and it ran just fine on the OpenBSD machine.
Yep.
It's just amazing.
So this is one of the interesting sort of upsides and downsides of a kernel being completely self-referential. So what enabled that to happen is that all of the fonts, all of the text, all of the graphics were done in the system itself, and you could count on them being bit identical. The downside is that if you moved it to some PC platform that had some certain font that you wanted to use, that wasn't a part of that world. And so you'd have to do extra weird work to get that font included. And then if you took that font and wanted to go somewhere else, then, you know, you had to deal with the native fonts in the other place. So there's this constant tension between having stuff simple, uniform, and internally defined versus having access to native fonts, native widgets, native this or that. And it's a constant tension. I don't know what the answer to it is. But there are these strong portability, uniformity upsides from doing everything in the system itself. And that includes also having the language be, you know, one single language in the whole system versus the access to all the, you know, the work contributed from all the other systems, the access to all the other systems and all the other fonts and stuff, if you don't do things that way.
Well, I know that there's some effort made to connect Squeak to cross-platform toolkits like WX and a few other things. That's opening up some of that. At least you have a sort of native widget feel to it.
Yeah. So that's the direction you go. And then in an effort to try and have your cake and eat it too, what you try and do is to, you know, if you're talking about native widgets, you try and have a layer. And there's one implementation of that layer that's all in Smalltalk so that it has that old everything is the same feel to it and aspect to it. And then you have another implementation under that layer that may give you the Windows widgets and another one that gives you the Mac widgets and so on.
Now, you left, not really left completely, but you sort of did a little less work with the Squeak community starting, what, about 4 years ago?
Something like that, yep.
And where did you go from there?
Well, let's see. So as part of the group at Disney, we eventually left Disney and we're kind of on our own and we're not stopped putting as much time into, you know, sort of being leaders in the Squeak community. And then we eventually, I left Alan's group after a little while and a couple of us did just because, you know, we were having, there was a period when we didn't have contracts for everybody to work on. And I was up in Truckee and I sort of, you know, went half into retirement and half into my weather station company. Got that going again.
Cool.
And can we buy these now online?
You know,
I want one.
Yeah. The short answer is you cannot, but it's a constant conversation in my household. About
when are you going to sell that thing?
Whether you could,
you spent days and weeks and years on it. When are you going to sell it?
That's fine. Exactly. Do you actually have a working, you know, you must still have a working prototype though.
Oh yeah. Yep.
Is it, not all software. There's hardware too. Or?
There's one in my living room.
Oh, cool.
What I did as part of that little hiatus was, you know, I had Squeak, so I rewrote it all in Squeak. The original one was in, get this, Visual Basic on a DOS box.
I'm not going to say anything. That's okay. He started in Basic. What the heck?
Yep. I told you I was agnostic. You know, sometimes you just you work with what you got. And that was the only thing that was cheap in those days was DOS boxes from China. So I did. I rewrote it all in Squeak, so it was much nicer. And then, and I had a fun time putting together a Squeak PC. And actually, Michael Ruger, who's often on the Squeak list, did the neatest version of that for me. So this is a little box with a Via.
Chipset. Yeah.
And so this thing, it costs like, you know, $100+ and runs off of 12 volts and doesn't generate enough heat to need a fan. So it's
you
one of these
called
things.
Nick Negroponte. I think he could have used that.
Yeah. Well, no, he was looking for an even lower price point. Yeah. But it's definitely, it was, you know, it was that, not, architecture, but that gestalt, which is right. the machine with a solid state disk and right. everything. So it had, I used to tell people it had two moving parts, the power button and the electrons. So, yes. And it all ran Squeak. So cool. A bunch of people, I think, picked that up and did a number of little embedded projects using it.
That's well, really they just ported Squeak to the, the Wi-Fi bot or something? Sort of more cool places where Squeak is.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting thing. It sounds like Squeak is kind of an embedded language in some ways.
It can be, because you can make it quite small.
Really?
That's if I have a fault in my computer past, it's to put almost too much attention on making things be able to be small. So there have been full Squeaks that took up less than a megabyte for the entire development system and the VM.
It's great for development. Is it also good as an embedded system? I mean, what are the advantages of using Squeak as an embedded language?
Well, the real advantage, as always with Squeak, is the productivity of developing stuff.
Fast prototyping and yeah.
The fact is that it's going to be slower than stuff in C or fourth is the archetypal winner as an embedded system.
Right. Well, it was written to be embedded.
Yeah.
Do people still use fourth?
Somewhat. There's certain, there are these enclaves that use it, astronomers especially.
Right. Well, that's where it started, right? For telescope control.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yeah. I think C has kind of taken that over.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you did the weather company for a while. And then, when did you start at Sun?
Just a couple of years ago. And, I guess I was looking around for, I guess this is, when the snow was about 12 feet deep in Truckee, I started thinking about computers.
Is that where the resort was in Truckee?
No. The resort was in Western Virginia.
Oh, that's right. But you live on the beach now. You don't live in the snow.
That's right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. Yep. Some of my old friends from Interval were at Sun. And, so I started talking with them and then, wound up hiring on here.
Very cool.
And what were you hired on to be?
Well, to sort of take over a couple of other projects. And then I started getting interested in web programming and then got specifically interested in what could be possible with JavaScript. And
Visual Basic wasn't tough enough for you, huh? Oh, man.
And this led you to Lively, right?
Yeah, this created Lively, yeah.
Tell us about Lively.
Okay. So, I keep saying, I'm an agnostic and you work with what you got. So when we looked, the germ of Lively was a dinner conversation that Antro Tyvalsari was at, and I was at. Antro had done one of the early Java VMs that wound up getting used in telephones, and I had my history. And we both thought that web programming would be an exciting kind of a project to have, but it just looked much more complicated than anything either of us wanted to deal with. In fact, he had just finished a course on web programming at a university in Finland, and so he was very clear about how complicated it was. And I just had that general sense. And we both sort of were saying, 20, 30 years ago, things were much simpler. And what's the problem? Nobody's doing stuff that's even as good as it was then. And so we started thinking, there is JavaScript and there is graphics. Why couldn't we just put that together and do what we did 20, 30 years ago? So that was the germ of the project.
I'm running Lively right now on my Safari browser, and it's, wow, this is in JavaScript.
Yeah, right.
Wow. So by the way, you do say run it in Safari 3. I guess that's for speed, because I tried running it in Firefox, and it really wasn't very fast.
Yeah, so actually, the very latest Firefox, I think it's like a pre-release or something,
the
3.0 beta 5, runs it decently.
Oh, good.
And it's much to their credit. And I think it was useful for them that we released the Lively Kernel. I think the Lively Kernel is now the SVG benchmark.
Yeah.
Yeah. People run just, well, no, that's not really true, but.
So this is all SVG.
Yeah. So you can do, you can do a system like this on top of any graphics.
It looks like Squeak kind of.
Yeah. Isn't that
what a surprise.
Amazing?
Yeah. This is amazing. I mean, I'm running this in my browser. Mm-hmm. Wow. Yep. Okay. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I feel like Steve Jobs seeing the world for the first time. It's amazing.
It's great.
If Steve had only seen this,
would have eliminated 20 years of computers.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yep.
So can you describe what Leo is seeing? I mean, what is, what I know I've seen it, but it's like substance. You can grab onto them. You can duplicate them.
Yeah. Talk so it is a simple morphic environment, just like the Squeak morphic environment. It's not nearly as well engineered, but it all runs in JavaScript. And what led us to SVG was just that SVG is a graphic system that is available in now a number of browsers that provides good anti-aliasing. It provides scaling, rotation, and translation, and it also supports good text. And I wanted all of those things so that anything that we did in the system could be rotated and scaled to any degree. And the important thing about it is that it's available. So we did an early version of this system on top of Java 2D graphics, and it actually performed a little bit better, but it required a plugin to run in a browser. And we were having a lot of fun with it. This is like a year ago, but we realized that it was going to, you know, all of the things we wanted to do. I mean, to me, accessibility is sort of everything. If you can make it easy for people to get at something, then they'll get it and play with it. And I knew that these plugins wouldn't make it through a lot of firewalls, wouldn't get installed in schools. And so all of us wanted to figure out a solution that didn't require a plugin. And so for these modern browsers, you can now run SVG graphics without a plugin. Mm-hmm. So it occurred to us that, you know, if all the Lively kernel needs is JavaScript and, say, SVG, then all of a sudden it can run with no installation.
SVG, I should explain, is scalable vector graphics. And it gives
it's
kind of like giving you flash-like capabilities in a browser, right?
Yeah. In fact, SVG, I believe, was kind of designed to be an open source alternative to Flash. Mm-hmm. We can talk more about that at some point.
Well, it's intriguing because, again, Steve Jobs shows up again. Doesn't want to put Flash on the iPhone and seems to be lobbying very hard to make SVG a standard on the iPhone. I think it's one of the reasons Safari does so well with SVG.
So when you see something like this, say that.
Yeah.
I haven't heard that Steve wants to get SVG on the iPhone, well, but I want to get SVG.
Yeah,
on the
it's
iPhone.
The speculation, and he keeps saying no to these other technologies.
Yep.
This would be, but who needs it? You've got SVG.
Absolutely. One of the cool things about the Lively kernel is that, you know, in this age of better performing hardware, you can do essentially all of the complicated animation features of Flash using just scripting together with the basic graphics of SVG. And the SVG as a whole is a large, complex standard that tries to emulate all of those, you know, animation features. Mm-hmm. But we, in the Lively kernel, we only use the very simplest basics. So I actually think that there is a quite simple subset of SVG that would be entirely adequate for doing all this stuff. And I think the same thing about JavaScript, for that matter.
So this is at Lively Kernel, for people who want to take a look at it while we're talking, .sunlabs.com. And do launch it in Safari 3 if you can, or Firefox 3.
And this is open source, right?
Yes. Yep.
It's hard to make it not open source.
Yeah, that's right. It's all being downloaded, I guess. Yeah.
So this is all pure JavaScript?
Totally. And so we call it the name, the Lively Kernel, we explain as it's lively because being all JavaScript, it is just a web page. When you start it up, you're thinking you're running either, you know, a graphics editor or a programming environment, depending on where you go with it. But it's so easy. In fact, you forget this minute to minute that it's just a web page. And the difference is that it's not, you know, it's not embedded in a text markup language. It's actual objects that are running in an object-oriented environment. So, you can take the system now and have, you can have a pane of text that's right and left justified that is tracking the mouse as you reframe it. And the text editor and everything in it is running JavaScript. So it's like you've got, it's an active object on the screen.
Wow. And I know there's actually a project, or at least some discussion about even hooking that into Seaside, so that you'd have a proxy object on the screen that actually represents a component on the server side. So you could have fairly tight coupled interaction between Seaside and Lively.
Absolutely. This thing is just, we can hardly keep up with it ourselves, but it should be really easy to just paste together a form that's viewing some database on a server and just basically be a dynamic GUI builder in which you could hook up to some enterprise database in 10 minutes, you know?
Well, stock widget kind of shows how that would work.
Works
quite well.
And it's so, yeah, if people are playing around with it, you're going to find some simple examples in there and some kind of less simple examples. So we did a certain amount of scurrying around in order to have some content to demonstrate. So there are some examples there that are really transcribed Java programs, and that will be obvious. But there are a couple of very simple ones too that will be obvious in their simplicity.
Yeah. It's proof of concept. Now, have you run this? I wish I had my iPhone here. Have you run this on an iPhone? Does it run pretty well?
It does not run on the iPhone because the iPhone does not yet have SVG in its Safari.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. And that's why I said the thing I said a few minutes ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the minute that happens, it should run there. Yep.
Very interesting.
Wow. So as we've been chatting, I've been watching the chat room, which is now thanks to the fact that most of the Twit programs go out on live stream. And I have a couple of questions that the chat room's asked, so if you won't mind indulging me here. One of them asked, what's your opinion of Objective-C?
My opinion of Objective-C? It's a nice environment. So I was there back when Brad Cox got it started years and years ago. And Objective-C was, I think, a much better thing to do than C++. And it's kind of too bad that it didn't take off more than it did. But Apple's certainly gotten a lot of mileage out of it. And I think, you know, if you asked anybody there, you'd get a pretty good endorsement for it.
Yeah. And with Apple's increasing market share, it's actually becoming much more important to understand Objective-C to be able to talk to the Cocoa bindings on everything.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yep. Yep.
We won't ask you what you think of C++. We'll leave that out.
But I did also, people also asked about Ruby. What do you think about Ruby?
What do I think about Ruby? Ruby's gotten a real place for itself in the world. I think by doing at least one thing better than Smalltalk ever did. I mean, Ruby in many ways is just like a Smalltalk with a layer over it. But Ruby did a couple of things. I think Ruby embraced the notion of pulling together disparate functionality.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one that's on the opposite side of this dichotomy that I've talked about a couple of times, where mm-hmm. You know, you can try to do everything in the system itself, or you can try to integrate everything around. And then Ruby also has done a better job of integrating with some of the server stuff on the web, and has really made a place for itself that way.
Mm-hmm. And just one other easy question. Not really, but how would you define object-oriented programming?
You have 30 seconds. Yeah.
Yeah. It's gone.
I don't know. I've never understood it.
He's a physicist. He doesn't need to understand it.
Okay. Yeah. I know. Just out of the blue.
I would say, you know, it's grouping objects with their behavior, which allows things to be much more modular, typically. And you know, it's a design principle that can be carried into all sorts of different areas, or you know, made rigorous to all sorts of, you know, degrees. And I'll digress a bit, because, you know, if this was I'm assuming this is a serious question. There, I think we have yet to see the real end of object-oriented programming, because I think that, you know, we're only now learning some of the ways in which it needs yet to be taken forward. And I'll mention one in the I'll point everybody at some previous work done by Mark Miller and others, and the name of the language I have in mind is E. And you'll find it on the web under erights, erights.org. And this is work, as I say, done by Mark Miller and others. And it's I think of it as being an architecture rather than a programming language. But it's taking object-oriented programming to the point of being a capability-based language. They talk about it as being a language for secure distributed processing. But the idea behind capability-based computing is that all you ever get when you get a reference is a capability, which basically means a handle to an object together with a set of messages you can send to that object. It may not be all the messages that that object understands. So you may not, for instance, you may not be able to write it, you know, to change its state in any way. Mm-hmm. And that's all you ever get. And if you sort of carry that through in a real language design, a real architecture design, you find that there are a number of things you don't want to do that you do, for instance, in Smalltalk, and it is a security weakness in Smalltalk and in lots of other languages, such as shared access to global state. Mm-hmm. And things like that. And that if you do follow these rules, you can suddenly start to make systems that are pretty much provably secure. You know, you can guarantee, I mean, if a system is actually built down to the hardware so that, you know, you can only send the messages given to you in your handle, in your capability, then there's no way around it. It's simple.
This is actually the basis of the 432 chip, and also of the i960XA. I worked on the for Intel at the time that they were making the XA, and it was just an amazing chip. And you're right, all the way down the capabilities, all the way down to the bottom. And the first question I had was, how do we back up the data on here if you don't have a capability to access all the data?
Right.
Because there was no equivalent of a super user. And I was saying, how are we going to make a backup program?
Yep. So it's I tell you, it's all going to come back again, because if I just sort of close my eyes and imagine 20 years down the road, when somebody has done this right, you can be sure that when somebody does it right, everybody will flock to it. I mean, because other things being equal, wouldn't you have things be truly secure? I don't mean obscure. I mean secure.
Absolutely.
And, yeah. So coming back to the topic at hand, or some of the topics at hand, Mark has moved on and is now at Google doing a language called Caja, which is spelled C-A-J-A, which happens to be the Spanish for box. And there's a pun there with modularity, I think. But I believe that I'm not sure this is true, but I think the name also came from CA for capability and JA from JavaScript. So it is a subset of the JavaScript language that is capability based. And you can imagine what Google's interest is in this, because if you had a JavaScript system that was truly secure, then you could invite advertisers in to share web pages with other material and know that they could do no harm. So there's a real economic reason for it there. And of course, you could go on to do all sorts of other stuff where you want security and, you know, bank clients and all that good stuff. So we are, that's a collaboration of ours. We collaborate with them and talk about the language design, and the sort of obvious cool thing for us to be able to do is if we could get the entire Lively kernel to run in their subset, then in some sense, any application written in the Lively kernel would be secure in that degree. So that would be a cool thing.
Very cool. And I also know that there's, if I remember right, there's some e-stuff being done with Squeak, or at least modeling being done in Squeak. And also the Spoon project is related to that, right?
Yeah. So I don't know how far, to what degree Spoon is done that way, but I know that Craig knows about E and is interested in it. Yeah. And yes, there was actually an e-Squeak that got partly done, but I don't think quite finished. And let's see, a lot of the principles are also in Gilad Braca's Newspeak, which is kind of a Smalltalk variant. It seems to be happening all around. Yeah, another place where those principles are, we got infected when we were at Xerox because Mark Miller, excuse me, when we were at Hewlett-Packard, because Mark Miller and his crew was there, and the Squeak crew was there for a little while. And one of the people in our crew at that time was Andreas Raab. And he, as you know, is working on a forum system that grew out of Croquet. And a lot, if you take a careful look at their design, it has a lot of the good features of E in it.
Very cool. And just one other thing on the object-oriented programming versus, I mean, a lot of people tell me OOP is sort of behind or old stuff, and functional programming is where it's at now. What do you think about that?
What do I think about that? They both have their strengths. If I had sort of created a universe in the functional world, then I could be good at making comparisons, and I can't, I'm not well enough versed in the other way to make those comparisons. I can say that, you know, there are significant sections of Squeak that I did in a completely functional way, and I loved doing that. And at a very nitty gritty level, I've tried to make parts. I've played around with language designs that took advantage of the sort of the how storage grows and shrinks, and what you can do as garbage collection tricks if you do things completely functionally. But you need to find somebody who's more balanced in that regard to get a good answer on that one.
That's a fair cop on that one.
And when are you going to write a language called Devanagari? That's what I want to know. That'd be a good name for a computer language.
It's already been done.
You can think of all sorts of backward reasons for the acronym. Dan, I really want to thank you for your time. I mean, it's such a pleasure to talk to a pioneer in the industry, the guy who was there when Steve Jobs first had his eyes opened to a graphical user interface. To talk about all this stuff and to see what you're doing now, which is fascinating. This Lively kernel is just very interesting.
Okay, great. Well, it's been an opportunity to talk with you and the folks in your crew there.
Yeah.
And it just I keep going because it keeps on being fun.
That's all it takes. You're not going back to the hotel business then?
No, I don't think I am.
Okay. Thank you, Dan Ingles. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Dan.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Right. Well, that's Dan Ingles. I'm sorry. Daniel Haha Ingles Jr.
Yeah.
I love that. I read his bio before we talked, but I didn't realize something like the fact that he was standing there with Larry Tesler when they showed the GUI on the Alto and Smalltalk to Jobs. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know it was Smalltalk. You know, that's not said in the books anywhere. They just said, oh, menus, mouse, you know.
Well, that's one of the reasons I wanted to get him on, is just this crossover between what Park was doing from an abstract point of view, a research point of view, and what eventually became what every one of us is sitting in front of right now, which is a Windows and mice and all the whole thing. It's like this was the intersection of those two worlds. And I knew that Dan had been there, and it was just that's one of the reasons I wanted to focus in on those particular issues.
It's a shame, though, in a way, the heart has been ripped out of it. And this is what I was trying to get at. Jobs didn't know he was looking at Smalltalk. He saw the surface and duplicated the surface. And wouldn't it have been so much more interesting if he had got the whole thing and understood?
No, I've talked with Waz about this. When Waz was on one of our cruises, I actually asked him, I said, in those early days, I mean, why didn't you bring the full Smalltalk cross? He said, we did. We made the Lisa with it, but we looked at the price point of the Lisa and we said, we can't sell that. We need to tear it down. And so we re-implemented all of the graphics in in Pascal.
Pascal, that's right. It was all written in Pascal originally.
And
so it was simply that the hardware wasn't fast enough at the time.
Exactly. That was the only problem. Otherwise, we'd all be looking at Smalltalk today instead of all this mishmash of various machines.
Well, what do you think it would have? What do you think the impact would have been? I think we would have had more elegant software for sure.
We wouldn't have had the divide, I think, between open source and locked up software. Mm. I mean, I think it would have been that fundamental, because one of the cool things about Smalltalk is your entire environment is open source.
Right.
You can drill all the way down into it and see every piece of it and change every piece. And think of giving that set of Legos to every single programmer.
Well, not just programmers. You know, one of the things that always comes up with open source for me is, open source, if you know how to read it and modify it, but that's a very limited subset. However, these systems are really designed, and you see this on the OLPC and Squeak, these systems are really designed for anybody to get in there and modify. And then open source is meaningful if I, as a user, can say, you know, I don't want to scroll a line at a time. I want to scroll a bit at a time. And can do it. And that's what really Squeak gives you, that kind of deep capabilities without being a super programmer. I think you'd see a lot more people doing that.
I think so too. And I'm really happy to have had Dan on. I gushed in the middle of the show. I am a bit of a fanboy on this about Dan, because he's really what he helped create. Again, he's one of these fundamental, earth-shaking, changing, landscape-changing kind of conversations that just created, the whole what the rest of us get to play in.
Well, and it's a treat for me, because I think one of my goals is to really get the names of these people. People talk to people like Ward Cunningham and Dan Ingles, you're talking to people who change the world, and they're not well known, even among us geeks. And so it's really important that people know who these guys are and what were they thinking and the contribution that they made. So I'm glad, Randall, that you brought Dan by. Boy, it was a real treat to talk to him.
And again, Leo, thank you for creating this show where I actually have a place where I can go ask Dan, to come talk on a show. This is
always been my goal. And, now that we've got the live video, you got to start bringing some of these people up here so we can have them in person and people can see them and so forth. And we will, because one of the things we're going to be able to do is get some Skype video up. We will at least be able to see you. That'll be a start.
I don't know. I'm going to hold a hand puppet up, I tell you.
I've done that. I've been known to do that. Yeah.
People see me in other places, so why not on TV? I guess it works out.
You were great on The Lab when you came up. I'm sad we can't do that anymore. But hey, I basically set up a studio here that's the same thing.
You're only an hour and a half flight away from me. I'll just have to get down there.
All right. Good.
Okay.
So, Randall, thank you for bringing back Floss once again from the dead, resurrecting it every time. What else we have planned in the future? Some good stuff?
Working on a few things. I think I've got a couple people lined up for next week.
Did you get any audio from Brazil? I know you were down there for a, open
no,
source
it just got so busy. Too many Kuiperinias, actually. So
yeah, that's what I thought. I knew the thongs and Kuiperinias will get you.
Although the big announcement from there, since you did bring up Brazil, is that while I was down there, I created they created for me a full 3-day small talk track to be added on top of the other tracks that they have. So here's a conference being attended by 8,000 people from all over South America, somewhere from around the world, and they're going to let me run an entire 3-day mini conference within the overall conference.
When will that be? Next year?
It'll be June of 2009. So Porto Alegre, Brazil, beautiful place to go. $60 to attend the conference. So it's basically just the cost of your plane ticket down is what you really have to worry about. And it's going to be incredible because we're going to have stuff all the way from the beginning, small talk, all the way through advanced stuff. We're going to do some OPC stuff. We're going to do a lot of seaside stuff and training. And I'm going to get the best trainers from around the world.
How exciting.
I'm doing training. Yeah, it's just amazing.
And Randall, what's Larry Wall going to say? You're now Mr. Smalltalk. What's going on here?
He'll be turning to me for small talk advice about how he's implementing Pearl 6. It'll be there. It'll be there. But, I'm
Pearl's your bread and butter. But I have to say, small talk is your joy and love, I can tell.
At least this year. We'll see. When it starts paying the bills, it'll be even better. But so far, the bills have been paid minimally by small talk. And in fact, I just did a Pearl class last week. If anybody's out there listening, they're going, oh, my God, he's totally small talk.
No,
I just did a Pearl class last week. I'll probably be doing a Pearl class coming up in a month or two. So it's not like I've abandoned Pearl. I'm just saying this is my year of sort of really developing small talk, taking a look at it and bringing it back to the forefront, because I think this is the time when this can happen.
The machines are fast enough. Platforms are there, and boy, let's bring it back because I want to see that power in everybody's hands. I think it's very exciting.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Randall. We'll see you next time on Floss Weekly.